Now, this was obviously an exaggeration, or at least it's obvious now in the perspective of a couple hundred years later. The real situation was a lot more ambiguous than the way that Margaret had presented it. Hardcore convinced Calvinists were certainly a minority, and active iconoclasts in the Netherlands were an even smaller minority in the Netherlands. But nevertheless, this widespread attack on the Catholic Church, on the art of the Catholic Church, and on the property of the Catholic Church fairly clearly had at least what we might want to call the passive assent of many Netherlanders, because very few of Philip II's subjects were actually willing to fight for the old church. They might have not been willing to join into its destruction, but they weren't actually willing to fight to defend it. And we know this because where the urban militias did obey orders and move to defend the churches, as they did in a few towns, for example in Lille, in Louvain, and in Bruges, there was no iconoclasm at all. But where these urban militias refused to act, the magistrates were powerless. And this was often the case. In Middelburg, we know that the urban militias just simply said, "We won't. We won't fight for the church, we won't fight for the Pope, and we won't fight for any monks." At Ghent, there's actually an interesting record because the militia was actually polled by the city government to find out how many of them were willing to go to arms to defend the traditional religion. The answer, less than a fifth. And in this kind of a context, the traditional authorities, the magistrates of the towns, were simply powerless. In the city of Antwerp, for example, during the iconoclastic fury, the magistrates simply had to hide in the town hall. They had to hide there during the image breaking, and they stayed in the town hall until all of the dust, quite literally, had settled. Now, iconoclasm, it should be said, although it was widespread, was really concentrated in particular parts of the Netherlands. It was most common in the provinces of Flanders, Artois, Hainaut, and Brabant. But nonetheless, it was too much for Margaret of Parma, and she was ultimately forced again to capitulate. On the 23rd of August, 1566, she issued a document called the Accord. And in virtue of the Accord, Margaret conceded freedom of Protestant preaching in all places where it was already taking place. Again, sort of going back on the line that she'd tried to hold earlier in that year. Nevertheless, although Margaret was willing to concede the freedom of preaching in places where it was already taking place, she insisted that it spread no further. And she also ordered that the grandees, Orange, Hornus, and Egmont, enforce the Accord, and she ordered that the Confederates assist them. The problem in all this is that although Margaret, from her own point of view, had made fairly significant concessions, the Calvinist minority wasn't going to accept a freezing of the religious situation on the 23rd of August. Like their compatriots in France had felt in 1562, they felt that their moment of triumph had come. They felt that they had God on their side, and therefore the iconoclasm persisted. It went all the way through the month of September, and it petered out really only in October of 1566. Moreover, and from a political point of view, this is really the significant point, the ongoing iconoclasm, the ongoing defiance of the Calvinist minority, was actually more or less encouraged by the Confederates and the grandees, who weren't willing to back the crown to the hilt. For example, when the grandees actually arrived in the provinces, they were dispatched out in the provinces to implement Margaret's accord, they didn't really cleave to what Margaret would have regarded as its requirements. They began allowing not just the preaching of by Protestant ministers, but actually full-scale Protestant worship and the actual building of Protestant churches. And, unsurprisingly, once the Calvinists had gained some degree of recognition from the official government, they, of course, became bolder. They began asking for more. They began asking for more than one church. They began establishing their own ecclesiastical organizations, appointing elders, appointing deacons, appointing consistories. They began performing baptism. They began performing marriages, burials, and communion services on top of mere sermons. And very large congregations began forming, especially in Holland, Hainaut, and Flanders. And some of these congregations we know seem to have numbered up to or even over 1,000 people. Margaret of Parma, unsurprisingly, was completely appalled at what was going on. There were concessions being made in her name that she had never authorized. She really never had any intention of allowing open Calvinist worship in the towns, and she was furious about the way in which the grandees were twisting the accord that she had issued. What was happening was that the grandees were finding themselves backed into a position that was really untenable. The regent, Margaret of Parma, mistrusted them, and the court of Spain, which was being informed about what they were doing, also mistrusted them deeply.